Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are delighted to be joined by Professor Suqin Ge. Suqin is Professor of Economics and the Director of the Center for Future Workplaces and Practices at Virginia Tech. She holds a PhD in economics from the University of Minnesota at Twin Cities.
Professor Ge is an applied microeconomist with a broad interest in labor and development economics. Her work has covered a wide range of topics, including education, wage inequality, discrimination, migration, and the labor market implications of emerging technologies. She was awarded the Department of Labor Scholar in 2015.
That's a really great
achievement. That is very impressive.
Yeah. In 2024, together with collaborators Chu Chiang He and Sudipta Sarangi, Suqin published the article, Reaping What You Sow, Historical Rice Farming and Contemporary Cooperative Behavior in China, in the Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization, which is one of my favorite journals, Derek.
I sense a mild untruth to that.
Well, we've been through so many economics journals on this podcast.
That's very true. And you know what? I really enjoyed this one. I was super fascinated.
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, as I sort of said, we've been through a lot of economics papers, more
Absolutely.
Than perhaps I was expecting.
That's
okay?
true.
Okay, and they're all great, and I've learned so much about them. But I think this is the first one that's actually been a sort of historical economics paper, okay, where we've actually been quite deep into the past and looked at the economics of the past and the social organization of the past and how that actually affects us today. I think that's the first time we've done that.
I think you're right. Yeah, we've gone through quite a few different topics, but this one places us into that historical paradigm, and it connects cooperative behaviors, which is in the title, mm-hmm. with some of these histories. So mm-hmm. it actually opened up a lot of questions for me, coming from a family with farming backgrounds and stuff, but absolutely zero rice farming.
I love the way you just segued yourself into that. Rice farming in China. I can own that.
It's because I have no understanding of rice farming except in this kind of sidestepping manner. Okay. So I'm looking forward to learning
more.
You
do farm rice in Canada, don't you?
Mostly wild rice.
Right. I did try that and it was not great.
Okay. I enjoy it, but okay. it grows at the side of lakes. So it's not as cultivated as the kinds of rice that we see in this kind of production.
Okay. Because when we think sort of rice farming, we think kind of really tasty sort of, you know.
Do not slag wild rice. You'll anger all of our many Canadian listeners.
Moving on. Welcome, Suqin.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation, and thank you for the very kind introduction. So it's a great pleasure to be here.
Oh, we do our best. Yeah. Even when they're way outside our area like this, but they interest us so much. Could you give us an overview of your paper, please, and tell us about the topic and the main argument?
Yeah, so let me tell you a little bit about the background. So we all know that a little bit of competition, especially if it's healthy, never hurts anybody. But on the other hand, the secret sauce that makes the world go around is cooperation. Working together for a common purpose can help us tackle everything from climate change to water scarcity. You know, think about all the hot topics these days, right? Mm. Trade agreement, better policies, ending the war, world peace, all need cooperation. Yet, a large body of research shows that people and countries differ in their attitudes towards cooperation and willingness to trust one another. So that's one reason that topic of cooperation continues to be of interest to researchers in diverse fields like economics and even evolutionary biology. So researchers have suggested that many of our current behaviors may have had their origins in ancient agricultural practices. Take gender inequality, for example. So Even today, countries that adopted plow agriculture in antiquity are more gender unequal than agricultural societies that relied on hoes.
Interesting.
The plow requires gender, like greater upper body strength. That make men more important in those societies. And this like cultural, like social norm kind of persistent. And then that's why it still has an impact on today, like people's behavior and gender attitude. So although research into this is relatively recent, this way of thinking is not surprising since agriculture was a predominant economic activity for most of human history. So that leads us to ask, so is it possible that agricultural practice developed in old days still determine our culture and therefore our notions of cooperation?
I feel that we often actually forget that, just how kind of, just for what substantial period of time human beings were engaged in agriculture.
Yeah, so
that was huge, yeah. Wasn't it? That was our lives up until extremely recently in human history.
Predominantly in agriculture, because there are lots of people who are still involved in it.
Sure.
Though I'm really interested in this concept of technologies of agriculture as well.
Mm.
So there's, you know, a number of different correlations, rice being a particularly labor-heavy crop, as you state in the paper.
Mm.
I was wondering, too, is rice as a crop particularly resistant to the addition of agricultural technologies?
Yes, so that's a great point. So I think this is related to the idea of like rice was like very labor intensive.
Mm.
So we got interested in like thinking about how, you know, historic agricultural practice, in particular, rice farming affects, you know, cooperative behavior today. So by the way, so this is a joint work with Chi Chong-he. So she's an associate professor of economics at Dongbei University of Finance Economics in China.
Mm-hmm.
And then my colleague, Dr. Sudipta Sarangi, he's a professor of economics at Virginia Tech.
Mm-hmm.
So we started with thinking about, like, you know, what's the difference? What's unique about rice farming? So in particular, like how rice farming is, you know, different from like farming other crops, like say wheat farming.
Mm.
So since we are looking, you know, at China, so in the northern China, so primarily they farm like wheat, whereas in southern China, primarily is rice farming and especially like wetland, like paddy rice farming. So first difference. So the rice farming and wheat farming differ, you know, at least in two ways. So the first difference is, the wetland or paddy rice farming, you know, is more labor intensive, as Derek already mentioned, than wheat cultivation. So why rice farming is more, you know, labor intensive? Because, you know, preparing the field, mm-hmm. and, you know, transplanting. So that's like very important for mm-hmm. rice farming. So usually farmers were just like, you know, like, get the seed, let it grow. Like once they have like 3-4 like, leaves and transplant it to a bigger field. And transplanting is like very, very labor intensive. You have to do like especially in standing water. It's very, you know, hard work and labor intensive.
Very and hard then, on the back, it looks like, because you're bending over to put this in. Yeah.
Excuse me. Exactly. So especially, you know, you think about, you know, you may ask like why, like then, you know, people do transplant, right? So why don't you just like another way to grow rice is they call it broadcasting.
Mm.
You basically just throw the seeds and then just let it go. And then so it takes much less time, right?
Mm.
But then the yield is very different. Productivity is very different. Transplanting is hard work, but it generates much more, you know, output. It's much more productive, makes the farming itself. And then, so transplanting seedling is very labor intensive. And then also like the post-harvest activities like stacking, threshing, all like require a lot of labor.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these labor like beyond like one person.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they always like, you know, work together.
Mm-hmm.
So another...
You know a lot about rice farming.
Oh, yeah. We did a lot of research. So I was born in a rice region in China.
Oh.
Even though I've never done the one day of rice farming myself.
I was going to ask you, actually, where did this interest come from there? But it's your own background, of course.
Yeah, so you know, I saw like my mom, you know, used to like grow rice. And then, you know, I saw her, you know, hard working. And also like the other thing I want to mention is like rice grows best in water, in standing water. So that's another very unique feature as compared to wheat. So why it is, you know, why this is important, because wheat farming usually can just rely on rainfall because they don't need a lot of water. Whereas like rice farming grows better in like standing water. But then if you rely on rainfall is not predictable, right? Sometimes you have too much water, sometimes you have too little water. So then that's why like people like build sophisticated irrigation systems so that they can maintain this water level.
And then, terraced rice farming is very common, isn't it? Where you have cascading water going from smaller plots into one another.
That's the very famous scenery we see in the south of China.
Beautiful. Yeah, for those, like you see, like the most beautiful thing is like when the rice field are flooded and then with the sun shining on it, like the reflection.
The glass plains, the glass fields.
But then behind that, it's all hard work. Imagine like building this irrigation system is a lot of work. And then building this irrigation system, it's not like a one-shot game. So you have to like constantly maintain it. There are cracks you had to, you know, fix. If the land is not leveled, then the water will be wasted. And then you also have to like, you know, build these like, you know, canals, and then so that the water can be channeled to different field, to different family farm. So these two features, so one is, you know, labor intensity and then also irrigation. So made rice very different from wheat.
Absolutely.
And also, as you know, I was asking, I think it makes using machinery a bit more difficult, doesn't it? Because especially when you have terraces and getting a tractor up and down, that would be nearly impossible, wouldn't it?
So the next part of your paper is basically talking about how this intensive labor and this unique form of farming led to an increase in cooperative behavior.
Yeah. So what we argue is that, so in between, actually, there's an intermediate step. So what we argue is that historically, so this is a way how rice has been farmed. So it requires a lot of labor and then also requires irrigation system. And then as a result, so there'll be a lot of what we call labor exchange because it's very labor intensive. So people need to help each other. So basically, if I have a piece of land, I grow rice. And then, you know, if this is the day I need to do like transplanting or I need to harvest my rice, because it's like everything happened in a short period of time, then I cannot do everything all by myself at once. So my neighbors help me. But then tomorrow, my neighbor has to do the same thing. I help my neighbor. So there's like the kind of the implicit contract in a sense, like, you know, we help each other. So that's what we call like a labor exchange. So labor exchange itself is cooperation, right? And then the other thing is with regarding irrigation. Again, the sophisticated irrigation system, you cannot build it all by yourself. You have to build as a team, usually as like a village, you know, they build the irrigation system together. So they need to work together. And then how the water is allocated also involves a lot of collaboration, right? So when and how much water I get, each family gets. So they need to negotiate and they need to, you know, cooperate so that everybody gets a fair share of the water and fair share of the work.
And this sort of behavior, it goes on over generations.
Yes. So what we argue is that this type of behavior exists, like, you know, thousands of years ago, but then that generates that, you know, forms like the social norm or culture of like collaboration. So people say, well, these are important because, you know, rice farming relies on this type of activities. So then this culture passed along generation by generation. And then as a result, even nowadays, you know, in the rice region, you know, people, you know, farm rice, they may have the direct, you know, experience of farming rice, but then even those people just come from the rice region, but they don't farm necessarily have to farm themselves, still inherit this kind of culture. And then that that affects their behavior today.
How does that manifest as behavior today? Can you define this cooperative behavior you refer to?
Yes, that's a very good question. So we're very fortunate we have this survey data from China, from the...
Yes, the surveys were very impressive. They were huge.
So the Income Project. So that survey, so they ask people, the survey itself is like ask a lot of question about, households like income and, their economic activities. And then also, of course, their socioeconomic, characteristics. So we're fortunate. So in one of the surveys, so they have a social network questionnaire. So in that social network questionnaire, so they ask people about rural households, questions like, how often do you borrow, lend money to your, friends and neighbors? Do you help each other with, constructing the house? As you know, in rural China, people, usually build their own house. And then how often you take care of each other's, your neighbors, relatives, if they have say medical needs and things like that. And then also how often, you help others, with job seeking.
Mm-hmm.
So we use these questions as kind of indicators of cooperative behavior. So because, people help each other, basically, mm-hmm. Put in the plain words. So, and then, we're fortunate to have these, variables, from that survey. So we collect those, data, and then we attach, for each household, we know where their, where their village is. And then given their village information, then we know their county, and then we look at their county level historic rice farming statistics. Then we connect sort of the historic rice farming with the contemporary, cooperative behaviors.
I was quite interested in that you drew kind of geographical boundaries across China.
Yes.
In your paper, and you sort of were able to define these into certain regions, depending on their history of rice cultivation. Can you tell us a little bit about this? Because it was more diverse in China than I thought.
Yes. So first of all, within China, there's huge diversity. So there are regions there was zero rice. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then there are also some counties there, more than 80% their, farmland are devoted to rice farming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the way we define rice farming is a percentage of, farmland that, used for rice farming. So it's a continuous variable. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just, look at kind of the look at the Chinese map and look at the county level, the rice farming intensity. So we see from north to south, there's increasing intensity because, south is warmer, mm-hmm. south has more water, and then, the temperature is, more suitable for rice farming.
Mm-hmm. And this has changed over time, hasn't it? The climate has changed, the environment has changed, and the farming has changed.
Yeah, that's a great question. But surprisingly, the rice farming, is very stable.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to measure historic rice farming. Mm-hmm. But then unfortunately, at the county level, the earliest data we can find is from 1957. Then you say, well, that's not historical.
It's getting there. You've got 75
years. Well, it's old to some of us.
Yeah. So then we dig further. Okay. So the turn of century, about 100 years ago, there's an economist called Buck. So he did a rural survey. So from that survey, we're able to, locate province level rice farming statistics for about 20 some provinces in 1918. So that's the earliest, a province level rice farming statistic we are able to, find. Mm-hmm. So we see a very strong correlation, a correlation 0.9, mm-hmm. Those province level statistic from 1918 mm-hmm. to then the, 1957 county level, converted to province level rice farming. So because I think until, very recently, of course, we talk about climate change and everything, mm-hmm. but climate actually is quite stable over time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can look at so we actually also constructed based on climate data, index called a rice suitability index.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why we see these variations across China, north, there's very little rice farming, primarily wheat farming, and south, primary rice farming, is because the climate conditions are very different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So this rice suitability index, it just combines all the, temperature, precipitation, and then soil quality, and then all these different, climate characteristics and then they construct an index and then to see whether the region is suitable for grow rice.
Mm-hmm.
You see a very, very strong correlation between rice suitability and actual rice farming.
That's absolutely fascinating. So your paper argues that within these communities, even when they're no longer rice farming, this cooperative behavior, this collectivity, it sticks.
Yes.
It continues. And that interested me because I wonder, I mean, does that continue to be the case in very modern China now, where we now see this huge kind of significant economic development and urbanization sort of fast track now? Do we still see this collectivity hanging on?
Yes, yes. That's exactly the question we try to answer. So the data, the cooperative behavior data, like say borrowing, lending money, helping each other, like, you know, with family and then, you know, house construction, job seeking. So these are contemporary data. So these are data from 2004.
Right.
So, and then, so we do find that, like, answering your question about, like, whether this is, like, actual, you know, rice farming or versus, like, kind of the historic, you know, effect, you know, through cultural persistence. So we actually look at, you know, not just the people who are still in the region doing rice farming. So we're looking at, you know, in rural China, a lot of people stop, you know, growing rice, right? Even though they're, you know, located, they live in, you know, rice region. So they do like non-farm jobs, right? So they work in local industries. And then there are also some people who, you know, don't work currently. So in our sample, we actually are able to separate these people, people who are still doing farming and then people who are non-farm workers and non-workers.
Mm-hmm.
So we separate these two samples and then we look at whether rice farming, you know, have an impact on their cooperative behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We find actually very similar results.
Okay.
So which shows that it's not the rice farming experience itself. You don't necessarily have to have the experience of rice farming. But if you grow up from that region, so it's the cultural that sticks.
Mm. And you also, I was impressed by the way you accounted for other variables. Because you said there are issues such as ethnicity. There's also religion as well. And you were able to kind of address each of these and say, actually, it's the farming, it's the rice farming that is the main influence here.
Yeah, so the way we sort of, you know, pin down the rice farming effect is now I'm going to introduce some like boring economics jargon.
Oh, nothing boring about that.
So let me see if I can explain it. So you mentioned like we use a line, right? So that's a famous line called Qingling Huaihe line.
Okay.
So Qingling is like the mountain ridge, you know, in the middle of China. And then Huaihe is like a river. It's like a very nice, almost like a 33 degree parallel line. Okay. So that's like historically is considered the border between northern and southern China. Okay. So what we use is what we call like a geographic discontinuity design.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the economic jargon I introduced. But let me try to explain it to you why we use that, you know, that line. Okay. Because, you know, you may concern about, we try to argue that it's rice farming that affect cooperative behavior, right?
Mm-hmm.
So someone may question like, say, what if it's more cooperative people? So they are more suitable to do rice farming because rice farming requires all this cooperation.
Yeah.
That's why they choose to do rice, right? Instead of grow, you know, wheat, they grow rice.
So this is the correlation versus causation.
Exactly.
So issue.
Yes. So to address that type of criticism, and then also there are criticism like, you know, what if, you know, even though we controlled a lot of characteristics, like say household level characteristics, village level characteristics, but there are always some characteristics we don't observe, right? Mm-hmm. What if it's just like those villages, they choose to grow rice, they're not unobserved, somehow they're different.
Mm-hmm.
And then the difference causes both the rice farming and cooperative behavior. So the last Derek mentioned, that's a correlation versus causality question, right? So economists always, you know, care a lot about whether this is, you know, causal relationship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in order to establish that relationship, that's why we, you know, take advantage of that, you know, Qingling Huaihe line.
Right.
So because along that Qingling Huaihe line, we see a 30% jump. difference in rice farming.
Okay.
And then why? Because Chinese climate is dominated by the monsoon from the ocean.
Mm.
So in the summer, the monsoon comes in, brings water, and also brings warm temperature. So that's why southern China is warm and, you know, there's a lot of rain, where the mountain range blocked it. So the monsoon cannot, you know, it's not powerful enough usually to go across a mountain range.
Mm.
That's why in northern China, you know, temperature is lower, so it's colder, and then also much less rainfall. And then, you know, periodically, you have like drought in northern China. So because of this, you know, weather pattern, and then that's why just, you know, across this line, so, you know, you moved from south to north, so you see a big drop in rice farming. So that's why...
You also do compare this with the Yellow River, don't you?
Yes.
So you use that as a...
Yangtze River.
Oh, the Yangtze.
Yeah, sorry. Yangtze River. So we use that as like we call a placebo test.
Mm.
Because, you know, like if you look at north versus south of like Yangtze River, so there's still this latitude, you know, difference, right? So then you could argue that there's still some like, you know, no temperature, climate differences, but difference is not that big.
Mm.
So that's why, you know, like across the Yangtze River, north to south Yangtze River, so we don't see this big jump in rice farming. And as a result, we also don't see that, you know, difference in cooperative behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Qingling-Huaihe line, you know, we see this big drop, like a big difference. So moving from north to south, there's a 30% jump in rice farming. We say, well, this is really generated by some exogenous, you know, factors.
Mm-hmm.
And then because of that, we use that variation, and then we look at how that variation generates cooperative behavior change, and then we can more confidently say this is caused by the rice farming difference.
This is absolutely fascinating, and it's also very clear, actually. I think you're underestimating the amount of economic jargon we've had on this podcast already.
But also how much of it is actually easily placed into a real-world context.
Yes.
So as long as we can do that, then the concepts are relatively easy to grasp, I would think. One thing I was curious about, so the four kind of cooperative variables are, you know, whether people will lend or borrow money, taking care of babies and the elderly or the sick, job seeking, right? Helping with the kind of job seeking, and then house building, so assisting. So you briefly introduced that. I was just curious, though, because in other places, these are all things that we would pay to have done.
Mm-hmm.
So does this take into account the economies of this, or is this just whether people are willing to do it full stop?
Yeah, so this is, I think, this is related to like the labor exchange idea I know I mentioned earlier. So like with the rice farming, because, you know, it's very labor intensive, and then people, you know, it's difficult to do things by themselves. So they do a lot of labor exchange, like the, you know, transplanting season or harvesting season. So people like get together, help each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the same idea. So that's why like we argue it's like it's a culture. So, and then that leads them to like, you know, like you said, like these are the products or services you can buy from the market, right? Instead of like, you know, getting from the market. So they have this like informal, you know, contract, like sort of labor exchange.
Okay. So in this case, the question is whether people will do these things for just exchanging labor.
Yeah. This is essentially for free. They just help each other.
That's great. Mm. So it reminded me a bit in terms of housing. So in some rural communities, particularly religious communities in Canada and the U.S. that are agriculturally based, they do things like barn raising. So the whole community will come together. They'll put up a barn building for farming. So this is very similar to that, although they're not rice farmers.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, I guess, those tend to be religious communities. Mm-hmm. The variable when you were looking at religion, mm-hmm. only the only significant difference was in caretaking, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe you can unpack that for us a little bit. So what kinds of religion or religious differences were there, and how might that affect this particular study?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think that's something, you know, probably, you know, we could study further. So the religion, you know, first of all, religion is not like as pervasive, you know, in China mm-hmm. as, you know, in the US or in Canada. Mm-hmm. And then our data is also very limited. Mm-hmm. So data basically asks, you know, do you have any religion? So okay. most people, like say, you know, in the Western, you know, world, people sometimes interpret like Confucianism as a religion. But in China, it's not a religion.
Philosophy.
It's just a philosophy, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, a lot of Chinese people may go to temples, but they will not identify themselves as Buddhists.
Right.
So like very few people actually in the service, you know, self-reported them as having a religion.
Okay. So there's a greater distinction between religious and non-religious.
Yeah, so it's basically like whether, to. Yeah. And then it's a small fraction. Mm-hmm. So, and then in our study, we said, well, let's control for that and see if that affects anything. So, but we are not able to really like say, like Buddhism, Christianity, you know, Islam. So they all have very different cultural and norms, right? So
yeah,
we are not able to unpack all these differences.
That,
given our data.
Yeah.
That I find very interesting. And it actually kind of leads on to my question as well, which was that China is not the only place in the world that farms rice
yeah.
and that produces rice. And there are other countries where this is a major industry. I'm thinking places like Thailand, places like
yeah.
Vietnam too. To what extent do you think these results can also be applied to other historical rice farming communities and nations? Or are there kind of other variables that maybe change things and make it different?
Yeah, so that's a great question. That's a great question, but it's not an easy question to answer.
Mm.
So the reason is that
we don't do easy questions on this podcast.
I like difficult questions.
Good.
Come
academic.
On. Yeah. So the reason is that if you look at kind of a cross-country comparison, then there are a lot of other different things. Mm-hmm. Institutions different, first of all, right? So the reason we pick China is because China, like historically for thousands of years, ethnically, and then also, you know, institutionally is a unified country.
Mm-hmm.
So then we sort of already condition on a lot of things. We don't have to worry about the differences. Like say, if you compare like Thailand versus, you know, Vietnam versus China or versus India,
mm-hmm.
like say religious difference, right? Like all have very different religion, historic background is very different, institutions very different. So then all these things very difficult to control. Mm.
Do you have any plans to broaden this project? And
yeah,
look at these different contexts.
So actually this afternoon I'm going to present a new paper on rice farming.
Excellent.
We started from the cross-country differences. So we started from cross-country differences. So if you're interested, I can tell you a little bit about the new paper.
Yeah.
So the new paper, we look at whether rice farming, because as I mentioned, so rice farming involves a lot of hard work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, we also, I mean, my own experience, like the Chinese parents, like, you know, always emphasize a lot about hard work, like importance of hard working, you know, to their children. So we're curious about whether this has an impact on the academic performance of children.
Mm-hmm.
So we started with like some cross-country difference. So we look at like, you know, there's this, you know, international standardized test. And they just test kids from different countries with same set of questions. And then we just look at the, you know, the country's rice farming, you know, history. And then also the average test scores of, you know, students from that country.
Mm-hmm.
We see a very strong correlation. So the rice farming countries, they on average perform much better than non-rice farming countries.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, the first question people will ask is, well, the countries are different, right? So the institutions are very different. So they're like, you know, the cultural background is very different. So how can you say it's rice farming? And probably something else, right? So, and then the next step we said, well, let's look at second generation immigrants. So for instance, mm-hmm. US is a, you know, immigrant country, right? So they have students, you know, coming from, you know, their parents come from different countries, but all the kids grow up in the US. So they were born in the US, grew up in the US. They experience same institution, they experience same, you know, school systems. So a lot of these things can be controlled, right? So then what we do is we look at, you know, again, this international standardized test. So we look at the, you know, test outcomes of these second generation immigrant students. And then instead of looking at their home, kind of their host country's rice farming, we look at their parents' country of origin rice farming. And we still see a strong correlation.
Okay.
This is fascinating. And there is one other kind of sort of variable I would almost like to venture here, because I spent some time in a rice farming community. I lived with a family who were rice farmers when I was doing my PhD research in Thailand, and I was looking at traditional forms of entertainment, really. Mm-hmm. That was sort of my topic. And one element I noticed, which was very important to my own research, which I don't think you talk about in this paper, was while rice farming was extremely intensive and labor intensive, there were also kind of gaps where you were doing nothing almost, you know, where you were sort of waiting, you know, you were between. So it was very intensive. And then you had this kind of this space, this waiting. And what I noticed was that for me, it was the need for communal activities within that space. And I was studying the media forms, the media mm-hmm. entertainment that kind of came out of that was important there. So there was sort of not just the labor intensiveness, but there was also the sort of long periods of sort of gaps in time between those mm-hmm. that became quite important. And people would all sit together in the village. You know, they would all sit together. They would entertain each other together in this way. And of course, they had large, big houses, and they were all kind of in sort of groups there. And it seemed to be that this was an important cultivation of the collective
sense
nature
of community.
As alongside working with ultimately the intensity of the labor at the same time I wondered if that was anything you'd also maybe considered too.
Thank you for bringing this up. So
don't mention it. It's amazing that I have something to contribute here.
Footnote at the bottom.
in that paper we didn't emphasize that. I think that could be another what we call like a mechanism. So mm-hmm. we emphasize two mechanisms. One is like the labor exchange, and the other is like irrigation. So you brought up like more like the social element, right? So we do see like, say for instance, like in Africa society, in African societies, so they also have like these celebrations, like, you know, after they, in a the harvest, like, because they're already together. So mm-hmm. they have these celebrations and so on. And then, like you mentioned, like regarding like these gap periods. So I think it depends on the different society. Like say in China, so I know China better. So historically, they only grow like rice for one season. Mm-hmm. But then as they know better and then like technological advance, so they can grow rice like two seasons a year, even three seasons a year. So overall, even with those gaps, like there are, you know, historic, you know, people have estimated like labor inputs on average, like rice farming, like labor inputs is at least twice than wheat farming. Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, you raise an, you know, interesting, you know, point is like, you know, say because rice farming brought people together, we said like, you know, we argue like labor exchange and everything, kind of the production side, but then the leisure time, they also may be more likely to get together, right? So yeah, we don't have direct evidence of that, so that's why that's not in the paper. But I think absolutely, though, that's also a very interesting.
But a really interesting.
I feel really pleased with myself.
Yeah, there you go. A very interesting piece of evidence that you do provide, though, is that you know, this 10 percentage point increase in farmland devoted to rice farming
increases the share of village budget spent on education, medical, and other public expenditures by 14.2 percentage points. So even if you can't talk about causation necessarily, you can show that an area that's more largely devoted to rice growth or rice farming does have more that it puts towards those kind of collectivist expenditures.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. So that's another thing, some other outcome, like variables we look at and we really like about these results. Because initially, we only look at like these cooperative behaviors, but these are not market activities like you mentioned, right?
I'm an economist at heart, I swear.
They're just like they're helping each other. Then we say, is there a real impact, right? Like we're economists to like economic activities, right? So that's why we go further. Unfortunately, we have the data to analyze those, so like whether rice farming like improve people like trust each other, because when there evidence, trust is important for economic activities. And then whether people can fare better than where there's like economic shock. Like I said, there's a natural disaster. So can they do better? Because if they help each other, then they can fare better, you know, when there's a negative shock, right? So we also see that. And then ultimately, whether if they, you know, they tend to, you know, collaborate, you know, cooperate, whether there's like a, you know, higher provision of public goods. So that's the results, you know, Derek, you just mentioned. So we do see that the local budget, like on like education, medical care, like these, like what we call like public goods provision improved, you know, in the rice, you know, is higher in rice regions. So we saw like that's sort of the real economic impact variable we consider.
That's a very hopeful note in a way. Now, one thing we ask all of our interviewees is whether there's been any criticism of the article. So this came out a little while ago. Have you had anyone speaking against it or criticizing the article?
Well, that's people generally like I think really likes the story, and
it does have a very good narrative. It was enjoyable to read. Yes.
Yeah, I think. Well, so I guess like the main criticism, I think there's also a question about, I wasn't, you know, prepared for this question, but like the question about like the publication like a process, right? So I think generally people will say, well, whether this is important enough.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought it was.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. So I think we don't get a lot of like specific criticism. You know, economists tend to like to criticize that it's correlation, it's not causality. But I think we took care of that pretty well.
Yeah, I mean,
well.
You do discuss this quite well in the article.
Yeah. So, and then the other kind of, you know, typical, you know, criticism would be like external validity. I think the question, Mary, you asked, right? So, yeah, even if we trust you, this is true in China, what about other countries?
Right, yeah.
So that's another, I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily a criticism, but kind of question, like, you know,
true.
You know, can you extend it to, you know, apply, like say.
How generalized.
In India, right? You know, how generalized this is. And then the other question, I guess, you know, is related to, well, you know, is there like, you know, you see this large impact and then how important to the aggregate, you know, economy.
Right.
So we sort of have like some very micro evidence. So we, you know, with our framework and our data, we cannot necessarily say, well, this will affect GDP by percentage point.
That would be an interesting experiment. We want you to increase rice production by X amount so you're more cooperative.
That's not our goal, but that might be a different paper.
Sure. Right. You've sort of preempted my next question, which was what do you hope for it to achieve from this paper, and what impact would you like it to have?
Yeah, so I think like kind of the bigger question is like the importance of culture. So I think that's like when you ask me like sort of where this topic comes from and what is the kind of big motivation, I think it's really important to think about this, you know, the cultural differences is important. So we really identify sort of one driving force, one determinant of this long-term culture. I think as, you know, economists, you know, like as a field, so I think we should pay more attention to these kind of long-term effects, and then instead of like focusing on like, you know, aggregate, you know, short-term shocks.
Mm-hmm.
I think these long-run effects, you know, have an, you know, important, you know, important implications.
Mm-hmm.
Even like a lot of historic events, you know, have long-term implications. So this is like the, yeah, so sort of lead us to think more about like, you know, different aspects of culture. So so this paper focused on this cooperation, like that aspect of rice farming, right?
Mm.
So the new paper I mentioned briefly, you know, rice farming because of labor intensity also generates, you know, or form this culture emphasizing, you know, perseverance and hardworking.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a different aspect. And then,
and
yeah.
What next? So you've got this beautiful trajectory set up. Where is this idea going?
Well, stay tuned. Maybe you need to invite me back.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you so, so much for joining us today. It's been really interesting.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Su Chim, for visiting us in the studio. This was a really fascinating paper, and I enjoyed reading it and discussing it a lot.
Thanks so much for having me, and no, thank you for the opportunity to share our work with your listeners.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.